Welcome to today's episode of Pipeline Things. I think you're going to find it particularly enjoyable. Our guest is rich in the history, working with the development of standards, going all the way back to the Office of Pipeline Safety. In this show, I've fully become a believer and acolyte of prescriptive regulation in the United States. You're going to want to pay attention to that. But no, more importantly, this is the final episode of our Sage series, and it's worth every minute of understanding how we got where we're at in this prescriptive regulatory environment, what a zero incidence looks like today, and even maybe what does the role of the environment look like moving forward, and how do we talk about that in our industry? Think you're going to enjoy it. Thanks for joining us today. Oh, gosh, that was a fail, Chris, but it's still a good start to the show. Welcome to today's episode of Pipeline Things. I'm your host, Rhett Dotson, my co-host, Christopher DeLeon. And again, we continue our journey through the Sage series.
I love the series, dude. I've heard all of, not only when they write pre-release, I've heard them at least two times. I just love them.
Yeah, you know, so very few people, little audience insight here. When I film the podcast, I actually feel like I go into a zone. And I retain almost none of what happens in the podcast because it's like I'm focused on so many different things. So when I go back and listen to them,
you're like, oh my God, that was pretty good.
Yeah, sometimes. And other times I'm like, I don't know how I did so well there. But the Sage series, I've had the chance to listen to a few of those already and thoroughly have enjoyed what we've been able to do here, Chris.
It's original gangsters, OGs, geezers.
I think OG series still would have been a good title.
Yeah.
Sure, we could have gone for it.
But I think we did a good job of achieving the objective.
I think so, you know, man. And so for me, I was thinking about, I just got back, a little audience insight. I've had a good summer vacation this year. My family had a chance to do a lot of the national parks, California. Highly, highly recommend if you get the chance to do national parks. But you know what's amazing about the national parks, Chris, is, and it ties in very well to this episode, is understanding how the national parks came to be, because they weren't always there. And believe it or not, we actually have pretty strict laws on what can become a national park and actually the difference between a national park and, I learned, a national monument. But if you go back and look at the history of the national parks in the early 1900s, Teddy Roosevelt actually played a role in that. They did it because they realized if they didn't preserve what was there in the United States, it wouldn't remain and would likely get commercialized. So we actually had some really funny things happening. Like, if anybody's ever been to Niagara and you see how commercialized Niagara Falls is, the Europeans were actually making fun of us when that happened. And the United States realized, hey, we have this gorgeous infrastructure we need to protect. And then at the same time in California, the redwoods are majestic. But like anything that's majestic, it also has a lot of wood. They needed wood in California for the gold rush and other things that were going on. Yeah. So people were cutting these amazing trees down, and the national public had this huge outcry. So if you actually look at the National Park Service badge, I learned this when we were there, it actually has a sequoia tree in the background as a reminder of why that institution exists today. And it's to protect the resources and the beauty that we have. So I think that history is just, it's cool to understand how and why we have those things.
It's also been inspiring, right?
Yeah.
Kind of makes you think like, oh, I want to help that. I want to contribute towards that.
Yeah, when you're there, you're like, I want this to stay like this. Awesome. I don't want people to be anywhere near this.
Why are you dropping that on the floor? Pick that up.
Did I get really upset?
Why is there a mess here? Do you see how beautiful this is?
Yes. Like, this is a General Sherman tree. This dude's 2,400 years old. You don't leave a plastic water bottle near the General Sherman tree. Yeah. So, it's really great. But, you know, I think it also...
Dude, the funniest part is, like, I could totally see you doing that. Like, I can already hear you yelling at Caleb. Why are you doing that, Caleb?
No, my family knew. Like, you might have been, like, on, like, probation. Like, missed the rest of vacation if you had done that.
I will put you on a plane. You're going home.
God forbid. Like, if I would have seen my kids break out a pocket knife and try and carve into something, there probably would have been... Yeah. I don't know, CPS would have been called or something. But it really ties in, I think, with what we've been trying to do in the Sage series, and in particular today's guest.
Yeah.
So I want to let the audience know, we do show prep before.
Yeah.
I have been very excited about this episode because this particular guest has been in the industry, like all of our sages, a long time, and brings a rich understanding of the history of how and why we got to the regulatory environment that we have today.
Yeah.
And I'm looking forward to him being able to share that with y'all.
And you know, again, one of the reasons why I feel like we've done a pretty decent job in putting this series together, and obviously kudos to everybody that's joined us, all of our guests, is they all kind of bring a different perspective.
Yeah, they do.
Right? So they all have been in the industry 30 plus years. They've all kind of had a focus, right? So, I mean, whether we look at Dr. Lavis or we look at Jerry or Dr. Dave, you know, Russell, whoever it is that we brought on, they all kind of give us a perspective, all looking towards the same thing, but in their own view, right? So we can kind of learn a little bit from all of them. So it's really exciting.
Yep. So without, you know, again, we're going to go ahead and bring our guest on. You want to introduce him?
No, go ahead, brother.
Oh, right. So we are going to bring Andy Drake. Please come on, take a seat and join us here. It's really my pleasure to bring Andy on. And I'm going to let him introduce himself. So, Andy, what did you think of that segue? Were you just marveling at
how? I'm impressed with the passion and the energy. I have to admit, I'm honored to be a part of the Sage series and not the Old Geezer series. That really felt like quite a promotion, actually, right away.
But you got to thank Dr. Dave for the geezer term. We made it quite clear in that episode that it was his term, not ours, it was applied. So if you don't choose to self-ascribe that term, it's okay. We'll go with Sage.
I'm proud to hang out with folks like that. That's a good group. Sage or Old Geezer, either way, works great.
But, So Andy, I kind of alluded to it in the introduction. I'm really excited to have you on because just the history and perspective that you bring with so many more years of experience. I don't want to say, if you add Chris and I's experience together, you probably have more than that. And certainly to a lot of our listeners who are younger. I mean, we bring maybe on average 3, 5, 10 years of experience, and you have substantially more than that. So,
but I want to add to that if I can real quick.
Go ahead.
But it's also the type of experience, right? Like Russell, you know, brought that whole perspective of control room management and, you know, the evolution of like paper to automation and how in technology can support with things like focusing where you need to. And I won't go through all of them. My point is everybody's had a different perspective. And, you know, one of the things that I appreciated is just your role in industry, right? Not just on consensus standards, right? Like standards development or R&D, but rather that role of helping make choices, right, from a regulatory perspective, right? So I just wanted to surface that as well. You know, you've been a really important role in that. Obviously, I wasn't around for the formation of IMP 1.0, but obviously on the gas side for what we call IMP 2.0 or the new gas rule, I mean, you were front and center there with the GPAC. So appreciate it.
We're getting a little ahead of ourselves, but that's okay. Andy, if you don't mind, will you introduce yourself to the audience? There's probably a lot of them that may not be familiar with you, didn't have the luxury of working with you. Who are you and what brings you on as a sage in the natural gas or pipeline industry?
Well, 42 years ago, I graduated from the Ohio State University, background in mechanical engineering. Welding is my background.
You're a welder.
Well, I actually have been a welder at one long period ago. Not on the pipeline, fortunately for the pipeline people, but I have... you know, I've been very fortunate to work with Texas Eastern, started to work with Texas Eastern right out of college and have stayed basically with Texas Eastern and subsequent companies since then through Enbridge. And I was fortunate enough to get involved in some of the technical research work at a very young age, construction work out on the projects, got involved in failure investigations because of my background very early in my career. Which is very eye-opening, you know, to see a failure hands-on right there, to see what can happen, you know, when things go wrong, and then try to focus on what needed to happen to avoid that is quite a personal lesson, you know, a very personally and powerful message. But I was then moved into basically working with the ASME committees and ended up being the chairman of the ASME gas pipeline standard, and was chairman of the effort that led to the B31-8S document that became the subpart O of the regulations, and worked with a great group of people, you know, folks like Dave Johnson, Alan Eastman, Mark Harris, you know, Keith Lee was people like this, just super, super great people, very intelligent people, help kind of make a step change in the industry around where do we want to take integrity management. you know, 2.0, so to speak. You mentioned that. How do we want to advance the standard of care? And then was asked to serve on the advisory committee to the secretary, what they call the gas pipeline advisory committee, to PHMSA on all rulemakings. That was 22 years ago. So
22 years ago, you were asked to serve on the advisory committee for gas pipelines. That pre-1.0, so pre the first regulation.
That was the first regulation.
Wow.
That's when I was chairman with ASME, they asked me to sit on it because of the work we were doing on the S document. And sat on it ever since. Wow, that was 22 years ago. It's been a long ride. You know, you think back on it. That's a long time.
This is going to be great. So you were around when the OPS existed, before PHMSA was even formed.
Yes.
Yeah, you've seen it all.
And, you know, PHMSA was really struggling at the time with a lot of issues from public confidence about incidents that had happened and whether the current regulatory structure was adequate and whether they were aggressive enough and whether industry was subscribed enough to try to prevent incidents. There was a huge concern by the public about operator diligence and PHMSA's diligence even. And so that's really where I think the press came on to step up our game, so to speak. And at the time, what we really did was, you know, looked at other industries, frankly.
When you say at the time, you mean at the time of like 2001 or?
No, this was back in the mid-90s.
Okay, big 90s.
Mid-90s, we really were looking at other industries to try to see what were other industries that actually had their social license challenged? You know, things like the nuclear industry, the medical industry, the aviation industry, where the society really stepped in and said, we're not okay with the track that you're on right now. Mm-hmm. Or this is so scary from a consequence standpoint. We really need to make sure we're sure. And what did they do to really step up their game? What did they really do to improve the confidence in the decisions they were making on managing integrity? And so we borrowed heavily from those industries, you know, risk management approach. And that was really the foundation of the S document. I mean, we really brought people like Mark Harith and Bernie Seligan from other industries, from the Hartford steam boiler and nuclear industry background, people that had done those things and said, hey, you know, we're going to come up the learning curve a heck of a lot faster because we're going to borrow and heavily leverage what you've already done and know and apply it to this industry. And that was huge. It helped us collapse the time that it took to get those things into place. And a lot of different thinking was going on at that time. And kudos to people that stepped into those committees and worked on the job, because they were really being challenging paradigms that were very old. You know, how we approach things, why we were doing certain things. And one of the things that we really coupled that with was some work that Keith Lee was personally very involved in it, and that was what we call the Emeritus Report, and that was go out and interview the writers of the original code. Why did these requirements exist? Where did 72% come from? Well, it was an 80% confidence interval around an assumed 90% hydro test. Okay, so if we test to 100%, we could operate at 80%, which is literally where the AMOP conversation came from. Where did section valves come in from? Well, that was the distance between roads in different parts. You know, section roads were so far apart. And as you got to more urban environments, the roads were so far apart. So it wasn't so much about a specific distance. It was really more about getting to the valve quickly because the road is near you want to be near a road. So it was more about shutting the valves quickly than it was specific distance. Understanding that helps us then understand, well, if that was the goal or that was what was really important in the development of the regulation or those requirements that even preceded the regulation, now we understand how to protect the intent.
Yeah.
And that was really important. What was the intent of some of the regulations? What were they trying to accomplish? And then we can marshal efforts and adjust things to try to achieve those same goals or even improve on our ability to achieve those goals with different practices, but protect the original intent.
You know, it's really funny, as you were saying, I didn't realize y'all borrowed from other industries so heavily in the writing of 31.8S. But it was funny, as you were saying, you were referencing the nuclear industry. As I look at pipelines, I'm like, pipelines are a lot older and more mature than those industries in many ways. But those industries developed integrity plans probably because of public awareness sooner than pipelines did, which is just it was kind of making me laugh a little bit. I'm like, yeah, the pipeline industry is probably at least two or three times as old as the nuclear industry, but we had to go to the nuclear industry to take some of their concepts. That's funny to think about, right? It shows you how maybe little awareness there is of pipelines a lot of times in people's day-to-day lives, I think.
It's true. I think we, Run Silent, Run Deep worked for years for a long time. People didn't know we were there.
That's where we want to be.
And I think that was working for folks, but for a while. But I think, over time, incidents started to happen in more populated environments or in settings where society was not willing to tolerate that. And I think that's an important thought is, we are an imposed risk. We're not like when you decide to drive a car. So they say, well, we're safer than driving a car. It's like, well, yeah, but people decide to drive a car. They didn't decide to have a pipeline in their backyard. So now we're imposing a risk on people. And so the standard of care that they expect is very high because the person who's the risk is imposed upon isn't necessarily in control of the risk. So they're trusting us and they're trusting a fabric or a series of barriers around that risk to be effective. They're trusting the operator to be effective. They're trusting the regulator to be effective. And they require all of those barriers to be working that they may not have direct control over, really don't have direct control over. Mm-hmm. But they want some line of sight and some confidence in the effectiveness of those barriers. And I think that's really important for our industry to understand is we have an obligation to protect people. That is our number one objective is to protect them while we do our work to transport fuel.
Yeah, that's an amazing, honestly, Andy, that concept is amazing just because as you're saying it, most people when they choose to live somewhere don't assess whether or not there's a pipeline near it. Thankfully, most people aren't even aware of whether there is a pipeline near it. And I'm thinking just my own life, like I'm flying with my wife tomorrow to go somewhere, but we choose to take, that risk to get on the plane, right? And you're right, I can expect a burden of care, but I think when something is, you don't have a choice in a matter, I think your expectations are higher, right? When, even we just went through all these power outages in Houston, right? And I'm thinking like people expect to have power because they need it to go about their daily lives. People expect to be able to live safe and free from environmental disaster, even if they don't know that pipeline is right there. And that expectation is very high on public utilities. So
the public really depends on us and the regulator. And I think that sort of sets a tone of how clear is the regulatory guidance that the regulatory presence. A lot of people talk about prescriptive regulation, which is, a definitive set of guidelines that you have to meet. Versus more performance-based regulation, which is more of a goal outcome. Don't let this happen or do whatever you need to do to prevent this. Yeah. And there is an active debate, has been for many, many years.
Look, I've been caught up on it myself.
About prescriptive versus performance. Who and why and which one's better. I think it's an and proposition, and I think that's really important. In Canada, a lot more performance-based regulation and it works. It works great. But there's a reason it deploys easier and more logically in Canada than in the U.S. The number of operators is exponentially fewer in Canada. So there's more opportunity for a very intensive conversation around performance expectations and plans to meet them.
Yes.
And that's really important because performance-based regulations, in essence, are very vague. They're clear in their goals, but they're vague in the how-to. So public confidence is yielded in confidence around the how. What are you going to do to achieve that outcome? Because the more operators that you have, obviously the more variability you have in the possible permutations, combinations of things that are put that people are marshaling to achieve that outcome. So the regulatory obligation then is to step into that space to make sure those folks are diligent. And the more vague the guidance is, the more the conversation is really important about our operators considering that issue appropriately and thoroughly.
And if we take the public perspective and not we're in this industry perspective, it's the idea of like, how do you address accountability? How do you account, you said marshalling, but I'll say policing and enforcing. right? And so I really appreciate the idea of the and proposition, right? It's like the idea of prescriptive kind of leads you to believe. I've always thought of it as like to get to a standard of care, right? You got to get to a standard. That's where the prescriptive regs are trying to get you. And then back to what even B31A, the way it was designed, is it's, and then you have the option to move to risk-based engineering through performance-based plans, right? And so it's that and proposition. We see that as early as the B31A-S.
Absolutely. I think that it's a balancing act.
Yeah.
And you're trying to provide enough guidance and clarity to manage, especially when you have lots of operators and you have lots of different sizes of operators with lots of different capabilities and competencies and capacities. Yeah. And you're trying to say, okay, for a little operator, we need to give them a lot more definitive guidance.
Yeah.
Now, big operators with lots of capacity and competencies, you know, they can do some sophisticated stuff, and we might want to give them flexibility to be able to do something different, you know, more risk-based.
And also the ability to learn from each other, though, also, too, right? I mean, sometimes there's often a sense of, you know, we say sometimes that relationship between the operator and regulator can be adversarial, but, I mean, it's not uncommon for us to see that information is also withheld as a competitive advantage. Right. And so, again, interesting topic. And I know there's a lot of efforts to try to break those down. But whether it's technology companies, consultants, operators, there's still this vibe of, you know, sharing we will do, but only potentially to some point. And there, everybody has to go on a learning curve is, I guess, what I wanted to get to. And that's where that prescriptive reg, I feel like, supports that balancing act. Right. It allows that journey of learning and going through, you know, treading through the mud until you understand your system enough, understand the process enough and all that stuff to potentially offer you the idea of performance-based approaches.
You know, I think it's true. I'd like to say that we try not, you know, there's a general sense that we don't compete on safety. We try very hard to share information, try to define best practices and get industry standards developed that helps kind of disseminate what is an appropriate approach. But there's a lot of operators out there.
Yeah.
There are a lot of different sizes of operators, a lot of different levels of engagement, you know, and you know, I think that's what we have to be conscious of on the operating side is that the public isn't so much concerned about the greatest common denominator. They're worried about the least common denominator. That's the person that may be imposing the risk.
Who's the guy that runs the pipeline next to my house?
and their ability to differentiate the two. It's like, well, y'all look the same to me. I don't know you.
Public doesn't see a difference.
I don't know
there's
you.
There's one reg, and you're a pipeline.
So their confidence is really shored up on prescriptive baseline. You can't drop below this, and the regulator is going to be active to make sure we don't drop below that. And that provides some baseline of confidence for the public.
So you said something, Andy, it just sparked a thought in my mind, which is, and I've never thought about it, because again, I've had a lot of my own struggles on prescriptive versus performance regulation. And with the number of operators, is it fair for me to say that if you have a performance-based regulation, it requires more interaction or maybe a different or more intensive interaction between the operator and the regulator than a prescriptive?
I think it requires different, I'd be better, maybe more intensive conversation because it's not clear. It's not like do
it's
this
and
then we check the box.
Form.
Yeah, yes. You did it. It's more like why?
And they have to understand.
And then there's a conversation. Well, why did you do that? What were you trying to accomplish? How does this work? Do you have data to show that that works? And then I think there's just a little bit more intensive conversation about the why part of it. With the prescription, there's an intensive audit going on, which is more of a checklist. This says you have to do this, you have to do this. Did you do it? Yes, 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 no. Oh, that's not good. You know, and then they're just working down on it.
Yeah, because I'm trying to imagine, you know, with PHMSA, and even PHMSA has limited resources, what a performance-based implementation would have looked like in the United States would have been, I mean, I have to believe the number of resources you'd have needed on the regulatory side would have been more and even more technical. Was that part of the conversation in the 90s? Were y'all talking as y'all were thinking about drafting? I mean, you were advisory. what did that, was that part of the
this
conversation?
This is your fault. Explain yourself.
Yeah, it's your fault. Let's go, Andy.
Why did you do that, Andy?
Well, it was thoughtful. You know, it was thoughtful and discussed explicitly, you know, and it becomes almost pragmatic. You know, we've got hundreds and hundreds of operators, and then you have, you'd need to have that many or more, you know, enforcement people. And the problem is when you get that many more people participating, you get a lot of variability in what good enough looks like. And what is the conversation? So the more vague the conversation becomes, the different, you know, the lots and lots of variations of what acceptable looks like. And that becomes extraordinarily frustrating to both parties. So there needed to be some clarity about a target. What is good enough? What is something that you should be basing this discussion off of? And again, it's back to your point, sort of a both and, sort of a balancing act. You know, we needed a prescriptive base that was clear and diligent enough to pass the red face test, which was a challenge that we put out to ourselves back then. That regardless of where the regulatory world is right now, we need to pass the red face test with a landowner that we're doing the right thing because that's our obligation. And then set those requirements into place and then create a platform where you have an opportunity to vary from that. But it's clear what you're varying, more clear what you're varying from. It's not just totally goal-oriented. It's there's a prescriptive standard and an expected outcome there, which is a goal, that helps us be a little bit more centered, less variable around the prescriptive conversation. So the two kind of fit together. They kind of knit together.
I want to share like a little bit of a personal perspective. So obviously when I first came in, you know, I was one of those engineers responsible for making that decision of what am I going to do? And I wanted to make a database decision and I couldn't because there was prescriptive regulation. And I also had a real big internal conflict in this because I knew where I needed to send resources and I saw budgets and I couldn't because I had to go do these other things that I'm required to do, right? And it's very easy to want to challenge that. But on the flip side, I'll say this. Having been through a pipeline where you were doing baseline assessments, trying to understand what active threats you have on it, understanding that it may not be a class 2, class 3, class 4 HCA, but I know my right of way and there is a home within a PIR and I don't know anything about that pipeline in that area. And so what I can say is I have firsthand experience of saying I've been through that process of I learned a lot about my pipeline thanks to prescriptive regulation, potentially things that I wouldn't have known about had we not have prescriptive regulation. Not only did I learn about my pipeline, but as an engineer, I also developed. So I think of like this inauguration of integrity because it didn't always exist, right? And so I can imagine you guys back then trying to say, okay, how do I develop this that makes most sense? Well, I would say one of the things that we got though is it provided a runway for learning, not just learning about my asset, but learning what is integrity engineering, right? We have all this research that's being done for pipeline threats. Well, what are the pipeline threats, right? How do I address it? You know, we're still learning about hard spots. That's just a buzzword lately, right? And it's been around for a long time, but it's kind of like that prescriptive reg. I do feel like, yes, maybe there were more economical ways to allocate resources, economic conscious ways, not economical, like less dollars. But I mean, there's still some merit in it is all I want to say. You know, it has provided industry with a lot of data, a lot of activity to learn how to do this right, if that makes sense. You
Look, you too. I'm on board, okay? I'm a reformed thinking we always need to have performance-based regulation. I'm on board. I'm good with prescriptive regulation now. In the wake of the failure files in this conversation, I, Rhett Dotson, ascribe to the prescriptive regulations that we have in CFR 192 and 195 and hold none of the old sages responsible for that. Actually, I also want to let the audience know, I'm looking at our show notes. I have a million questions I want to ask Andy, and I feel like we could make this a four-hour episode. But we need to take a break so I can regroup with Andy, make sure that we can get all the content we want for you guys. We'll be right back in just a moment on Pipeline Things. All right, welcome back to Pipeline Things, where we continue our Sage Series discussion with Andy Drake on regulation. It has been it's been a lot of enjoyment for me so far. I don't know if I've ever been so quiet on a singular episode, but it's because I really don't feel the need to interrupt Andy. I'm just like, he's just going. I just want to let him talk, and I want to actually just sit here and listen to what he's dropping. But you know, we're gonna pick up. We're gonna go in a very specific direction now, Andy, because you've seen, you know, again, the advent of IMP 1.0. And then I know for sure, since I've been working in this industry, which is circa 2005, we heard this introduction of zero incidents. And zero incidents became a big push. And my first reaction, full disclosure, and I hope you don't get upset, I rolled my eyes when I heard zero incidents because I'm like, that's stupid. I'm like, I'm sorry, that's never, we don't accept zero incidents in anything that we do, and it's not achievable. So I felt like from my perspective, I struggled with zero incidents when it was rolled out. And I'm curious your thoughts. What does zero incidents look like today? And what are your thoughts on a zero incident culture? Oh, you grimaced. I like this.
Well, I can appreciate the complexity of that. And certainly when we rolled it out, it was met with a lot of conflict, you know, a lot of pushback. You know, why are you doing this? This is an unrealistic expectation. And it was, no, actually, this is a commitment that we have to make to the public, that no accident is acceptable, that we work very hard, very tirelessly, very diligently to try to make sure that we are operating at the highest safety standard. No breakdown is acceptable. Now, the pragmatic side of that is perfection is quite a journey. And I think that's a good word here, is a journey. What we were really, I think, also promoting with zero was a mindset of no tolerance, a mindset of constant learning, pushing to challenge ourselves to learn and improve, and to make martial good risk management choices. Mm-hmm. And where does that really play is? Well, if we seek perfection on one attribute, it can draw our attention off of other issues that might cause a problem. That's poor risk management. Mm-hmm. When we look to advancing the standard of care, the first thing we have to do is, what is the largest thing, what is the biggest opportunity we have to advance the standard of care? What is the biggest threat that people are experiencing, and what can we do most to move the needle? And that's where we should put energy. That doesn't mean we don't put energy elsewhere, but we work on that prioritization schema. Because if we don't keep plugging that schema and that logic in, you get distracted. Well, we're on this issue. And if we just did a little bit more, we'd be perfect. Yeah. And there becomes an exponential level of energy that you're pouring into it to get that last little micron of safety, that if you put that same block of energy into something else, another threat, you can make a huge change in risk. That's prudent.
Yeah.
And that's the journey. And we're constantly pressed with that. And it's, you know, the regulators have to be on that journey too. And, you know, and the public has to come on that journey with us as well. But we need to be able to articulate that logic and that journey. We are on a path to make sure no one is ever hurt.
Yeah.
We are committed to do that. We are marshaling all of our energy and our efforts to get there. The how to do it is risk management.
Yeah.
It is constantly plugging back into where do we make the next biggest improvement and putting our energies there. It doesn't get lost on the journey and marshal infinite amounts of energy into infinitely small amounts of improvement. That's irresponsible, actually.
Yeah.
That's irresponsible. And so people that draw us down into the perfection challenge are actually anti-risk management people.
Yeah,
and I think we have to push them back and say, that's not prudent.
So why didn't y'all call it no accident is acceptable rather than zero risk? I like no accident is acceptable.
The journey in front of it, you know?
Well,
journey to zero.
It's a part of a conversation.
Yeah.
I think this is the public's expectation.
Yeah.
And you're coming out to the middle of the field with the public saying, no incident is acceptable.
Yeah.
Now, we're on a quest to get to there. Here's how that quest works.
Yeah.
And this is prudent. And frankly, that's how the airline industry works. That's how the nuclear industry works.
Yeah.
No nuclear incident is acceptable. Yeah. No, it's not okay. No airplane accident is acceptable. It's like, no, it's not okay. And you have to start there because that's where the public who's experiencing this imposed risk sits.
Yes.
They have to know that you care about them and you are trying diligently, deliberately to make sure nothing happens to them.
And
it's logical and it's diligent and it's a process that you use to get there.
That builds trust.
That builds their trust and confidence, which is huge.
It builds trust. And I would say, you know, Andy, I always like to try to tie some of these discussion points back together because, again, we've talked about this a lot and I know some of our audience maybe are learning a lot from this year. So I like to tie things together a bit. And if you have anything to add to it, please do. The idea is it's, you know, we talked about prescriptive versus performance, right? And the idea how sometimes you have prescriptive regulation, it can kind of restrict you on that journey to zero, right? Because you're forced to put resources in one place where you have data and you know you should be putting that somewhere else. But I think that one of the things that you guys did a very good job of, like I said, because you were on the GPAC when what on this show we call IMP 2.0 came out, is it's, I do think y'all worked really hard. And I remember watching you guys to make that step forward in having what you said earlier is that and proposition.
it's prescriptive and performance. And one of the places where I see it, where I saw it the most, at least in my opinion, is an example that is how we manage dents. So for example, again, there is a prescriptive component that is required. And I think that you still have to do risk assessments. That's prescriptive. You don't have a choice. You will do risk and you will use data and you will integrate a ton of data. So we see words like any and all the time as it relates to data integration, and that will be prescriptive. But where we have that balance was in now what we respond to. And I think that's where we're starting to see some of those performance-based influences in regulation that you guys did move. So whether you're back in the 90s consulting, you know, and advising to now, I think that we are seeing some of that evolution, right, towards that AND proposition of saying, look, we know there's dents here. And because of IMP 1.0, we know a lot of these dents. We can profile which dents are injurious and which ones we think we can manage. Mm-hmm. How are we going to do that now? So now there's regs that allow us to do that, right? And it allows that notification to PHMSA to say, hey, here's what I want to do. Can we engage in the how and be selective about where we bring in this performance-based type theories and culture? And so just I wanted to tie all that together to say, I think that a lot of those efforts are coming together. And for the audience that are doers, that's kind of where some of it's coming from. And I wanted to help tie that together. Comments?
Oh, very insightful, because they are integrally connected. The performance-based regulation and approach can fuel a change in the regulations. Mm. If you get your industry leaders, so to speak, people have the capability, the competency, the capacity to do more deliberate evaluations, data gathering, and analysis, engineering analysis, they will come up with a better mousetrap. They will. They'll develop a better tool. They'll develop a better algorithm. They'll develop better risk assessment protocols. And once that is definitive, they can put that into an industry standard that then becomes a template that everybody can follow in a prescriptive regulation.
And potentially incorporated.
It feeds it.
Like a flywheel kind of.
Exactly. Yeah. Just like a flywheel. So the performance-based option actually can continue to evolve the prescriptive regulation clarity and flexibility to better get a better fit. Because right now the prescriptive regulations can be very, you know, broad and generic to cover the worst case scenario. But over time, you want to use the performance-based solution to fine-tune that, to dial it in. So, well, if you had this data or if you had this information, you could do something a little different in the prescriptive regulation, which is
touching on what some of the other sages have said. You know, that requires both operators to be investing in research, to be investing in advancement, investing in the standards. If you're going to get that cycle that Jerry talks about, right, which is where ideally, you know, research precedes standards, which then precedes regulations, right? You think about the performance-based stuff, that would have to happen as a result of that. You know, I had one thought as y'all were talking about. I don't want to continue the conversation too much on zero, but zero was tough for me because, you know, you said, you know, no accident is acceptable. I do agree with that in any industry, but things happen that we don't foresee. Fukushima happened, right? We didn't foresee a tidal, you know, the tidal wave that would come in and wipe that out, the flooding, the typhoon that ultimately brought that on. I think sometimes like Malaysia Airlines 370, nobody could have foreseen that you were going to lose that airline the way that we lost that airliner, maybe even the one that was shut down, the shutdown over Ukraine. Things happen in those industries that we still consider, I would say, acceptable. Maybe the landing in New York Harbor where the birds hit the plane and they took it down. And so I think I was thinking like we just lost power for a week in Houston. Mm-hmm. If you said something like no power outage is acceptable, nobody in Houston is willing to pay for that. Nobody, I promise. We are going to tolerate some level of power outage as a result of incidents.
But we're not internet. I'm sick and tired of the internet going down. God almighty. Holy smokes.
And so I still think that there is some – I like the journey discussion. That's what I like. But in our lives, we tolerate and understand that nothing is perfect. And even in pipelines, it's a journey. No accident is acceptable, but – we will, in the duration of my life, continue to have incidents because something's going to happen that we didn't know about. Or, worst case scenario, you're going to have a third-party accident. Somebody's going to strike a pipeline. So,
well, I mean, but I think the word is culture, right? I mean,
Andy, culture's Andy important. And transparency. Well,
right? And I think the message is it is unacceptable.
It is unacceptable. I do agree with that.
And you can feel that, right? Like, again, I think I speak for both of us when I say we love what we do.
We do.
Right? And we say round sound in the ground, that is what we're here for. And not just D2 integrity, but that's what we as an industry are here for, right? And so I think it is fair to say it is unacceptable,
yep.
Right? However, unfortunately, things happen.
And you want to be transparent when they happen.
And this is what happens. And the culture of how we address that, I think, is where potentially there's opportunities. I'll say it that way, right? Because, I mean, this is very complex. And you've said that and you've made that clear, right? As it's the intent and always valid, right? So,
and I think as an industry, I feel like we're doing good. I feel like when we have failures now, I don't necessarily feel like there's a defensive posture. I feel like there is more of a knowledge sharing posture. I think the operator often comes forth and says that the accident is unacceptable. They're not like, whoa, this accident happened and we're okay with it because we can't manage all of this. And look, we're actually having less accidents now than we had 20 years ago. And we're repairing, you know, they don't put this defensive posture forth that upsets the public. And so anyway, all right, let's leave zero incidents because I feel like we could just... We could go on. Maybe that's a roundtable discussion. The last point I want to close with you, Andy, was the original rule focused a lot on protecting life. We talked a lot with Keith Lavis about that when he talked about, hey, you know, the original PIR circle and 90% lethality. Everything, you know, they took a method that was reserved around protecting life. And even the introduction of moderate consequence areas in the updated rule, when the NTSB advocated for that, they mentioned that, you know, that failure location that happened so close to a major arterial right away could have resulted in loss of life, and they wanted to begin protecting against that. So they expanded it with moderate consequence areas. I feel like lately we've seen a huge shift, or maybe a shift in the conversation, to focus on environmental consequences. And I feel like that's coming for the pipeline industry, where we might see PIRs that are based on consequence area, or HCAs that are based not on proximity to life, but how much of a release you might have in the event that the failure occurs here. Do you have any thoughts on that, on whether or not you see, how you see environmental impacts coming into regulations?
I'm going to touch on something that you mentioned because I think it's really important. You said that we are now being asked to extend integrity management to MCAs because of events. If you read the S document, you'll notice it doesn't really talk about limiting integrity management to HCAs. It talks about this is how you do integrity management everywhere. Yep. And HCAs were defined as a prioritization schema. When we did this 20 years ago, we knew, we intended this to be deployed to the pipeline system. Yeah. HCAs was just a starting point. We knew there would be HCAs, MCAs, LCAs, low consequence. And the goal was to deploy it everywhere. And I think that's important. That was the original design.
You're consistent with Keith. Keith said the same thing. He said INGA actually had a commitment to have everything fully covered, I think, by 2024. And then they revised it to 2035 later on.
We revised our goal when we talked to Carl Weimer about how many people are we protecting. Not how many miles of pipe are we protecting. Shift the conversation. This is about protecting people. How many people? What is the percentage of the population that is provided protection, confidence via an integrity management plan? And then how do we, what's the next tranche? And what's the next tranche? And I think that's important because, you know, conceptually, we wanted to define an integrity program that would deploy to all pipes.
Yes.
It was just then, well, that's too big. That's back to risk management. That's too big an ask right now. So we start with where the high consequences are. Then we work to the next tranche. That's risk management.
Yeah.
And so that was fundamentally part of the design. I didn't mean to cut you off. No, I'm trying to answer his question.
No, but I had to jump in, right? Because again, I want to share this, right? As it's, we just talked about like the message that Zero put out, right? And I think something I wanted to highlight is it's prescriptive regulations can be hard because sometimes you don't see the value. But what we keep saying is it's people. And if you keep using the word people, life, people, things just begin to make more sense. And it provides a goal, right? It provides an ambition, a desire, right? So if I'm an integrity engineer or I'm an ILI analyst, you know, listening to this podcast, or, you know, I'm a potential future leader that's going to be on the GPAC or the LPAC or whatever, it's like, it is not hard now for us to understand, are there features or threats on the pipeline that will affect people? And that's easier to tie to than a PIR or a class location or a distance of pipe, right? It's, my aim is very clear now. When I'm looking at these inspection results, where am I affecting people, right? And I just feel like it's a little bit easier to hold, because I mean, I'm telling you, Andy, you look at these and you're trying to do your dig program, you're trying to establish your reassessment intervals, you're trying to fight for budget dollars, all of these things, and it's like, okay, class locations and 7-year inspection interval, you think about regulation, But if as the integrity engine decision maker, I'm thinking, great, communicate this in terms of people. All of a sudden it becomes easier, in my opinion.
It really helps. If you understand why you're doing something, then what you do makes more sense. If you understand, if you're going on a journey, have a destination, know where you're trying to go, that's really helpful, you know, in most journeys. But getting that clarity is really important. And I think one of the things we have to deal with, and this is back to your question, is what does society expect out of us? And now society's expectations of us is changing. You know, climate change is out there. People are very anxious about that. You've got a lot of pressure from society that this is something they're worried about. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say everybody, but a lot of people. A lot of people enough to get a lot of energy around this, a lot of emotion around this too. So now we're being asked to complement that with an and proposition of a different kind. Mm-hmm. We want you to protect people and the environment. When gas pipelines were designed back in the 50s or 60s, 30s, go back as far as you want to go, went way back when gas pipeline standards were being developed, primary concern was people safety and that methane was not viewed as an environmental hazard. So releasing methane to the atmosphere was not a big deal. And the systems were designed that way. ESD systems were designed that way. It was designed, put it to the atmosphere and protect safety. People. Okay. Yeah. Well, as we talk about now, you know, society wants us to look at environmental impacts also. It's like, okay, well, that's not the way the system was initially designed. So we have some very significant issues to deal with, not just leaks, but fundamental operational issues like valve packing and, you know, rod packing on equipment and, you know, leaking seals here and there, fugitive emissions, you know, blowdowns, ESDs, pigging. Yeah. How the system was designed wasn't designed around that premise. So we have to rethink that whole premise, which society is asking us to do, which is fine. It's just back to risk management. Okay, how do we go about making a big improvement on this? And I think this is really important for industry. Rather than arguing with society over whether what they want is right or wrong, it's what society wants is what society wants. Yeah. It's our obligation to deliver what they want. And then how do we do that? And create, we own our space, not just safety, but the environmental impact. And we're going to own that. And we're going to own a plan on minimizing our footprint because that's our societal obligation is respond. So that, I think, is a big part of the leak detection rule that was in place. You know, and it's going to be another journey. And that's another risk manager. Pick the biggest things that you can that make a big difference and then work to the next and work to the next and work to the next. And I think that will, you're starting to see that effectuated, whether that's through EPA with, you know, emissions from, you know, prime movers or PHMSO with, you know, leak containment. You know, those are all going to be just part of our obligation.
Yeah. And I want to ask you this question, Andy. It's kind of to get your thoughts on.
He has to answer it in 60 seconds or less.
It's okay. It's his show. Didn't we say that in pre-show?
Oh, I know, but Miss Producer's going to make him.
We're going to run out of battery? No, yes, I'm just kidding.
The batteries are going to run out.
You know, one of the beauties of this series that I appreciated is there's so much to learn from you guys. And one of the topics we mentioned, I used to call the silver tsunami, right? And the idea of, you know, loss of knowledge capital when certain human resources decide to retire or move on. And you have this generation that is relying on data systems and processes and other resources to learn. That's one of the things when we were thinking about the podcast was it's like, you know, it's hard for us. We've both been very privileged to have access to individuals and research and mentors. So we kind of wanted to stand some of that up with the podcast and make it available to people to be able to hear and latch onto. So I wanted to ask you, you know, with this mindset of this incredible journey you've had in pipeline and all your exposure, any comments to maybe some of the next generation as it relates to, you know, just general advice to, hey, get involved here or be cautious with this or, you know, X, Y, Z?
It's a great question, you know, because I do think that, you know, history has a funny way of repeating itself if you don't know what caused things, don't understand the basis of history, then you have a great chance to repeat it. And these learning curves were hard-earned. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of energy, a lot of money and effort put into these things. I think it's really important for people to make efforts to understand the why questions, the five whys. Why did we do this? Why? Really push yourself to understand and to try to not recreate work that's been done, but to collect it and understand. And I think that's really the beauty of the podcast, this series like this, where people kind of download what the thinking was at the time so that the next generation doesn't have to repeat it. It's like, no, we know that. We don't have to rebuild that. It already exists. We just build from it. And I think that's what I hope as we continue on that journey is don't get too lost in the journey. Understand the journey. Don't get frustrated with it too much. You know, it's a worthy purpose. I'm a
reformed believer in prescriptive regulation.
It's a worthy purpose, and understand it, and keep trying to advance it. Keep asking the why questions to advance it.
I just want to echo that, Andy. Bravo. I love it, because how many times have we been in a room where there's an idea proposed to do research that we've already done?
Yeah.
And your statement of, hey guys, and we're talking to the audience, I'm talking to the audience now, before you propose a research idea, propose a budget to learn what's already been done, right? Build on the work that's been done. You know, the lessons are hard learned. There's a lot of effort, and it's kind of what we tie to. Prescription regulation have allowed us to spend a lot of resources learning a lot of things. Let's collect that. Let's gather that. Let's render that. And then look at how we build on that.
You know, brilliant. And on that note, Chris, I'm going to wrap it up. This has been an absolutely great conversation. Andy, I want to thank you for joining us. I actually sincerely hope it's not the last time that we talk. You sparked a desire in me to want to do more with you and some of your other colleagues. And I want to thank you for sharing, you know, that history and your wisdom with the audience. And so to our audience, I want to say thanks for listening. Hopefully you enjoyed this Sage series. If you did, give us some feedback and let us know. Maybe punch the like button or send us an email directly if you have ideas of other Sages you think that would be a good idea to have on this podcast. But wrapping it up here, I'm your host, Rhett Dotson, my co-host, Christopher DeLeon. Thank you for joining us on Pipeline Things. This episode of Pipeline Things was sponsored by D2 Integrity, produced by ADV Marketing, produced and edited by Sarah Roberts with support from Morgan Hutchardson. We'd like to thank SmartPipe for letting us borrow their office, and all contents are copyrighted by D2 Integrity 2024.